Good afternoon. So, last time we talked a bit more about doing useful work with bitwise operations, and one thing we mentioned is that, well, a lot of these bit manipulation operators actually did lots of things at once, like bitwise AND and XOR did a lot of AND operations and XOR operations. And though when thinking of solving some problem with AND or XOR, you might think of just doing one at a time, if we want to take full advantage of what the hardware is doing, the hardware is giving us not one AND gate, but 64 that all work together, we should take advantage of that by trying to make each of our bitwise AND and OR operations do multiple useful ANDs, ORs, XORs, etc. We saw an example of that with this check if any bit set with this sort of fan-in structure where we didn't succeed in using all of the kind of lanes of the operation that the hardware provided, but we did a pretty good job. Then we talked about instruction sets versus microarchitecture. So instruction sets, we mentioned, were the software interface to hardware. So this included the machine code. So you might think of instruction set as, oh, it's just the instructions. No, it's the whole software interface, everything about how the software communicates with the hardware. So it includes the instruction set that the machine code specifies and what all those instructions do. And if we add things to an instruction set, we get a different instruction set. So we can have two machines which are implement a common instruction set, but if you've added features onto a new processor that mean programs on the new processor might not work on the old, that's different instruction sets. And this is contrast to microarchitecture, which is that for a given sort of set of machine code and such, we could have two processors which would do the same things when they executed them as far as the software was concerned, but would implement that in different ways. And most commonly, this would be because we have different design goals. That's why we want to do that. So if we were designing a processor to have the best possible performance, we're going to have a very different internal design than if we're designing a processor to have the lowest power consumption. So that was about microarchitectures versus instruction sets. But when designing instruction sets, we do think about what it means for hardware makers in mind. And we talked about sort of two different things we might have in mind when designing the instruction set, that software interface. And we talked about one philosophy which seemed to be sort of in the early era of computing what people were going for, which is they thought, okay, well, computers are about being convenient to program. And originally, people were programming computers directly in assembly. And so they were focused on, let's make that convenient. Let's add features to the hardware which are going to make programming assembly convenient, give all the useful operations programmers need in there. That should be our focus. And this led to what were called complex instruction set computers, where VAX was the sort of the most extreme example. And we have a lot less extreme examples, like x86, like has a lot of instructions, but it's not sort of as extreme as VAX and the amount of instructions it's sort of created for convenience of the assembly program. And in contrast to that, we had this RISC design philosophy, this reduced instruction set computer, where we said, well, even though it might be nice to have assembly be more convenient to program, that's not what we've ended up doing. We typically don't write assembly. We have compilers do that for us. So we can make writing assembly more tedious, and that's not a big deal. And instead, what the RISC philosophy says we should focus on in our instruction set is exposing to assembly writers and compilers the operations the hardware can do efficiently. So implement things that you can implement efficiently. Don't implement complex operations if those aren't things that your hardware is good at. Let the compiler writer generate a sequence of simpler operations that you can do efficiently to do that in the best way they can think of. This works better in our world where we don't write assembly by hand. It also means that we have more time to focus on our performance and less time we can be required to spend on things like making sure that all those instructions we implemented properly, because, fixing a broken instruction is going to be much trickier than fixing, like, a broken library function. You want to turn those instructions into things like library functions that previously, you know, we thought were sort of convenient to provide. So today I'm going to move on to talking about a specific instruction set that we're going to be working with in assignments for most of the rest of the semester. Maybe not most of the rest, but the next part of the semester, and something we're going to implement in a simulator that our textbook chosen as sort of a subset of x86-64, and we'll see that that subset kind of follows this RISC philosophy, well, at least significantly more than x86 does. So before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes, back there. So question, when writing machine code, do we place symbols in the relocation table? So first of all, when we're talking about object files, the machine code part is separate from the relocation and symbol table. So we have our data of the object file, that's the machine code. And on the side of that are sort of notes about the machine code. And relocation table entries are one type of note about it, saying that this machine code's incomplete. So we would place them as we were writing an object file. But the final machine code is not going to have any of that stuff because we're going to fill in all the relocations using the symbol table information. Does that answer your question? Yes.
For RISC or SysTest, when you're accessing, when operands are accessing memory, is that typically more of a RISC or, well, is that typically more correlated with SysTest?
So the question is, for RISC versus SysTest, I mentioned there's some difference about how operands access memory. So a typical way of simplifying hardware implementation is to have something separate for accessing memory, where the idea is that we'll have like some separate part of the processor we're thinking of designing that accesses memory. And also, as we'll find out later, often we have to do some calculations to access memory. And we don't want to do those calculations and also normal arithmetic at the same time. That complicates things. So we'll typically have instructions that access memory that are separate from our arithmetic instructions. So arithmetic instructions won't be able to access memory. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, if we had an object file with functions A and B, functions A and B would show up in the symbol table? Yes. And if function B called function A, then there would be a relocation table entry pointing to some part of some instruction of function B mentioning function A? Yes. Other questions? Okay. So let's look at this y86-64 instruction set. So as I mentioned, it's based on x86, but it's basically a subset, so it omits most of the instructions. So this is the complete list of instructions. I've abbreviated some groups of very similar instructions. So JCC means all the conditional jumps, jump less than, jump greater than, and so on. And CMOVCC is a family of conditional instructions we'll talk about explicitly in a moment. So I'm going to work through the weird cases on here. I'm going to start with move. So I mentioned move, it exists, but it's been renamed. So how has it been renamed? Why do they want to rename it? Because move seems like a perfectly reasonable name, except maybe we should put an E in there. And that's not what they're going to do. They're going to leave the E out still. So what are they renaming for? And what our textbook authors have chosen to do, and we'll see why in a bit, is they've chosen to split move into a bunch of different instructions. And these new instructions are going to be named with a character for the source type of the move, a character for the destination type of the move, and then move queue. So note that this move queue part, that all the instructions we're including are the 64-bit versions. We don't have any of the shorter versions. There's no at 32 bits, at 16 bits, doesn't exist. And same with move, move 64 bits. But we've divided it up into these versions where I have a letter for the type of the source and the type of the destination. So I have I for immediate. Immediate is the same thing as constant. That's what it means. For register, I have an R. And for memory, some value in memory, I have an M. And so this gives us 9 possible move instructions, and some of them won't exist. So some that won't exist for, you know, just it's not possible reasons are the moving to a constant. We can't move to an immediate, that's a constant. So we can't do a constant to constant move. That just doesn't make sense. We can't do a move from a register to a constant or a move from memory to a constant. So those just don't make sense, so they won't exist. So then we have 6 left, which would make sense. And we're going to omit 2 of them. And this is just a choice the textbook authors made. They felt that these weren't important to include. So one is moving from a constant into memory. So that's a useful instruction. But they decided we're not going to have it. So you might say, what if I want to move from a constant into memory in my assembly code? How do I do that? Well, you can move from a constant to a register, and then from a register to memory. So you can still do that. So we haven't lost any capability. We just are implementing less things in our hardware. And we also don't implement memory to memory move. So as you probably learned x86 in 2150, you learned that there's no move from memory to memory in normal x86, which is true. Though there is technically an instruction which does this in does this kind of thing in x86 that we're mostly going to avoid anyways. But we're not going to implement a memory-to-memory move to keep the hardware simpler. So what if you want to move a value from one memory location to another? Well, you move a value from that memory location to a register, from a register to another memory location. You can still do it, just takes more operations. And so we're left with immediate to register move, register to register move, memory to register move, and register to memory move. Those are our move instructions, which we split up into 4 instructions instead of just having one big move instruction. As I said, we'll have a good reason why we want these split into separate instructions in a bit. Questions on these move instructions? Okay, so let's talk about another special case in this, which is the CMove condition instructions. So these are instructions that exist in x86-64, but you probably didn't see them very much. So they're conditional move. And basically, they're equivalent to doing a conditional jump to skip a move followed by a move. So in this case, we have a jump less than to skip over a move, and if not, we do the move. This is the same as doing a move if greater than, which is how I'll read this CMoveG. So a common source of confusion on this is that people really want the conditional move instructions to do a comparison. They don't. The comparison, you know, happened above, just like with a conditional jump. So, you know, this jump if less than, something here set SF and ZF, and the same is true in what I have with the conditional move. So something set SF and ZF to make this work. So we did some sort of comparison with some other instructions, just like we would do for a conditional jump before this conditional move. Yes?
What does that seem like G part of
it? So the question is, what's the G for? So G is greater than. So the things we put in the CC part are the same things we put in a conditional jump. So there's a conditional move of less than, equal to, but it doesn't work in this case because we're moving if greater than. So the equivalent with conditional jump is don't move if less than or equal. Does that make sense? Questions, follow-ups? And if you're wondering what are the possible things we can put there besides G for greater than, we'll have a list later. Other questions? Okay. So we have these conditional moves. So you might say, well, we could simulate this conditional move with a conditional jump, like why do we bother adding this instruction? And as we'll learn about much later in the semester, we talk about ways of implementing processors. For many common ways of building processors, conditional jumps are actually fairly complicated instructions relative to doing a conditional move, which is why you might want to try to provide that to a compiler. So another instruction that was on that list was this instruction labeled HLT. So there's an x86 instruction called HLT, which you've probably never seen, because it's reserved for the OS. And basically, it stops the computer. On real hardware, stopping the computer is maybe a little more complicated of a thing than it's going to be for us, because we're going to deal with a simulator, and our simulator is going to like actually stop, and we don't have to deal with like turning off power or anything like that. And our textbook, they thought, unlike the move instruction, that maybe we can rename this instruction to have the full name of the thing it's about. So they renamed it to halt with an A. So that's just going to be our stop the computer, simulated computer instruction. And we need that because, well, if we don't have an instruction like this, what the processor does after running an instruction, go to the next instruction. So we can't just have the end of our program because, well, what the processor is going to do is it's going to say, okay, I'm at this memory location. Let's add to that, go to the next memory location. And there's going to be something there. So we need some way of saying, no, really, stop now. There's nothing more you should do. Okay, so that's about our instructions. So next I'm going to talk about how these instructions take operands. So this is going to be a bit different than x86 and basically simpler than an x86. So when we have instructions that specify a memory address, like we're used to doing for a move, they always have the displacement plus base form. All the other forms are not allowed. Now, as a special case, we can do the just a base address. And why is that okay? Well, because it's just the assembler putting in the zero for you. And we'll literally turn it into the same machine code as if you wrote in that zero. And all the other forms we're just not going to implement. So less work for you when you're writing your thing for the simulator. Also, the move instructions are going to be the only instructions where we can specify addresses like this to read from memory or write to memory. So that means that if you wanted to, say, add a value from a memory location to a register, well, in normal x86, you could use this add instruction where the first operand is a location in memory. In y86, this won't assemble because there's no machine code for that. When we look at our machine code, we're just not going to have a way of writing this. So you might say, well, that means our processor is less capable. Well, we can still do all the same stuff. So how can we simulate this, assuming we use R11 as a temporary register? So we don't worry that R11 might be used by something in the future. So I'll give you a little time. So which of these is actually going to have the same effect other than overwriting R11? Who needs more time? Okay, a bunch of people, okay. Okay, so who thinks A will do this? B? C? D? Good, we have consensus. No one, and also no one read the instruction in the wrong order. Okay, so yeah, we'll replace it with something like this, so we can still do it. We might need an extra register. We have memory, that's not going to be a problem. If we run out of registers, we'll just like put things on the stack. Okay, and so this is how we deal with that. We're not going to have the add instruction do anything but add two registers. And this also means that we think about constants. So usually you'd be able to like specify a constant. I remove Q is going to be the only instruction where we can specify a constant that isn't an address. So why I say isn't an address is because jump is going to take an address. We'll usually write it as a label, but remember labels get replaced with an address, and so is col. But other than those, you know, so as far as non-address constants, I remove Q is the only one which takes one. So that dollar syntax, only I remove Q. So this means that add the constant one, that's not a valid instruction. It's not I remove Q, can't put that constant there. Does this keep us from doing things? No, we just need an extra register. Move one into a register with I remove Q, then add it. And the overall consequence of these rules is that every instruction is only going to wow one kind of value for each operand. So the instruction name will tell you what kind of operands the instruction allows, because you can look that up, and there's only one possibility. And this is why we split move Q into four different instructions. So we could have this rule be followed, and this will become handy when we make our machine code for this. Okay, I'm going to go over in a bit what the machine code looks like. I'm going to go through how we can, you know, translate instructions to machine code and back. But first, I'm going to go over some instructions you, in theory, already know how they work, but they're the tricky ones. So we'll start with push and pop. So push and pop read and write from the stack, and they also change the stack pointer. So these are complicated instructions because they're writing to the outputs. They're the kind of complicated instructions that if we were really following the RISC philosophy, we might not implement, because they write to two places. In the case of push, we write to memory and a register. In the case of pop, we write to two registers, the stack pointer and some other register. And push has the effect of as if it decrements the stack pointer and writes to memory at that location. So the important thing is that we write to the decremented location. As we'll learn when we talk about implementing push and pop, it won't necessarily be the case that we actually change the stack pointer before we change memory. What matters is that the location at which we access memory is based on the decremented stack pointer, not the original. And for pop, we access memory at the location pointed to by the stack pointer and increment the stack pointer. And again, it's not necessarily the case that the memory access happens before the write to the stack pointer, but what's important is that the place where we access memory is the previous value of the stack pointer, not the new one. And note that because these are 8-byte pushes and 8-byte pops, the only one we'll be implementing, we decrease the stack pointer by 8 or add 8 to it. So questions about push and pop? Yes? The question is, for pushing, I do minus 8 because the stack is backwards. So usually I refer to this as the stack goes down. Yes, so the lower addresses are where the stack goes to. Other questions? So push and pop move a value to and from a register to the stack. And we have call and return, which are rather similar instructions. So call basically does a push, but rather than pushing a value from a register, It pushes the program counter, specifically the address of the next instruction, the return address, where you want to go back to after the function call, to the stack, and then jumps to the address specified by the label. As we'll learn when we look at the machine code, we're going to actually write the label in machine code as an address. And return pops an address from the stack, usually one that was put there by call, but doesn't have to be, and jumps to that address. Questions about call and return? So these are our most complicated y86-64 instructions. Okay, so we've talked about the instructions we act on. We should also talk about what information our processor tracks. So we have registers, and you might say, okay, we're going to have 16 registers, because that's what x86-64 does. Our textbook authors chose to omit R15, and this is because they had a hardware implementation in mind where it will be convenient to have the 15th register not actually be used. Or the 16th register, I should say, R15 being, you know, index 15 starting at 0. Also, because all our instructions act on 64-bit values, we don't have like EAX, AX, and so on. We don't have those smaller sub-registers. They just don't exist. Because there's no instruction that acts on less than 64 bits. Yes, in a real processor, you probably want instructions that can act on single bytes. We don't got them. We also have condition codes. So we have the conditional move and also conditional jump. So they need condition codes to work on. And you know they're going to be set by arithmetic instructions. So we have the zero flag, the sign flag, and our book has the overflow flag. We're just going to omit it from our homework assignments and just have our processor do the wrong thing for overflow, just to keep things simpler. If you relooked at that list of instructions carefully, you might have realized, wait a moment, there's no compare or test instruction here. How do we have condition codes? But remember, we said condition codes were set by all the arithmetic. So our arithmetic instructions over here will set the condition codes SF and ZF. So if we want to do a comparison, we don't have a compare instruction. But that's OK, because we have a subtract instruction. So we can do a comparison using that. Yes, it's going to be less convenient than a normal compare, but that's what we have. Just less to implement. So our textbook and we're also going to have some extra states. So we're going to have a field called stat, which is the status for the simulator, so telling whether the simulator should keep going or stop. And our simulator is going to have the option of stopping in different ways just to let us know what's going on. We have a program counter. So our processor is going to have to track what instruction are we executing now with a pointer. That's not in any of the normal 15 registers. So we have an extra value we're tracking. That's part of our state. And we also have main memory. So we have a memory, which we're going to just say, put in a 64-bit address, we get a value. Questions about our processor state? Yes?
Since you could call it comparison, if you want to do comparison, but you also want to like keep the value in the like destination register, when you use like the subtraction, it'll change the register, right? But you want to keep that value, but something you have like add it back after.
So the question is, if I want to do a comparison, but I want to keep the values in the register the same, do I have to add it back afterwards? So that would be one option. Probably the most natural option, would be you could like do compare AB, you could move B to a temporary register C and then subtract AC. And then just ignore the value in C. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay, so that's the Y86-64 instruction set that our textbook authors propose. And you can see it follows a lot of the sort of RISC design principles. and how it chose what parts of x86-64 to keep. So we have separate instructions to access memory. When we went to move values to and from memory, or use values in memory, we have to use these register to memory or memory to register move instructions, or push and pop. But so those are maybe not super RISC-like, but we have those special move instructions. We can't just do arithmetic on values in memory like we're used to in a more CISC-like design philosophy. And that's going to simplify implementation of, accessing memory because it's, only certain instructions need to do it. We also have, avoided really complicated instructions. So if you remember when we talked about facts, we had these instructions like evaluate a polynomial, which basically ran a loop in an instruction. And x86, if you know the full instruction set, has some instructions which kind of look like that. We didn't keep any of those. So all our instructions do like a single operation, and it seems like they should take basically a fixed amount of time. We also have few addressing modes. So remember, addressing modes means ways of specifying operands. We have chosen for each instruction one way of specifying the arguments. And you might say, well, that's, I can't easily identify locations in memory. Maybe so, but that's what we've chosen to keep our hardware simpler. That if I want to specify a memory location with a base index and a scale, I'm going to have to do the work myself. So there's some of the RISC goals where maybe we're in between. So we definitely have fewer instructions, but some of our instructions aren't simpler in the way a typical RISC design philosophy would be. So like push and call and return and pop are pretty complicated. They basically do multiple things. We'll see when we implement the hardware, they require us to sort of add functionality to the hardware that's sort of kind of only needed for those instructions, which could easily be done with simpler pieces. So for pop, for example, we have to write two registers at once instead of just one. So all of a sudden we need our, to have support instructions that write two registers where if we didn't have that instruction, we wouldn't need to do that in our hardware. Yes?
So basically, call and return both have.
So the question is, this means call and return are going to be implemented with something like microcode. We return them into other simpler operations. So that is certainly an option when we make our processor. That is not what we're going to do. So we're going to show a processor design that our textbook authors propose, where even though these instructions aren't so simple, we're going to still do them in the same amount of time as the other instructions. But this is going to mean that we're going to make some compromises. Like we're going to have our hardware structure that handles storing register values be able to write two register values at once, which is a significant cost versus having it only write one at once. So another implementation option would be to do the microcode strategy to split them up into simpler operations. But that also has other complexities. And that, it makes our process of loading instructions from memory a lot more complicated. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, and also, I mentioned I have this more registers. It's kind of ambiguous. So 16 registers is usually considered a higher number. So traditional CISC instruction sets often had much fewer because they assumed you were always accessing memory anyways, because all the instructions let you do that. But it's not like a super high number. And we're not going to have fixed length instructions. We're going to have variable length instructions. And there's a big convenience factor there, that if I have fixed length instructions, and I want that fixed length to not be very large, that means I probably can't have big constants. If I want 32-bit instructions, that means I can't have a 32-bit constant in my instruction because I don't have any space left over after I put it that there. And so our textbook authors didn't want to make that compromise, so our instructions will be variable length. So let's look at our instruction format. So this is a table I've reproduced basically from the textbook. So each line is instructions with one name or a family of names. We'll go into how we figure out which of the multiple instructions that can be specified by a line are in a bit. And we think about encoding or decoding. What we're going to do for decoding is we're going to look at this most significant 4 bits of the first byte to figure out what line we're on. So to read this chart, as far as what's going on, I have these byte indexes. So byte 0, the first byte of the instruction, is these first two boxes. And each of these boxes here represents 4 bits. So if I'm writing out bytes in hex, a NOP instruction is written 1-0. And I also sometimes have other 4-bit components, which I've like labeled CC or RI. We'll go into what those are in a bit. But those are 4-bit components for those 4-bit boxes. And sometimes we have these bigger pieces that, like V and D here, which correspond to the V and D in our assembly here, which are, in this case, 8 bytes. So questions about the basic structure of this table? So each of those boxes represents, each of those square boxes represents 4 bits. So we put them together to get a 1-byte number for each byte. And if we're like figuring out how to encode instructions, we'll figure out what line matches our instruction. If we're figuring out how to decode, we'll look at that most significant 4 bits and figure out which line we're in. Okay, so we have some instructions which are grouped together. So there's some which are marked with the CC for condition, and there's a table of what those values mean. So something we've done here is we've decided that register to register move, that's just a special case of conditional move. So register to register move is just conditional move if always. And the same is going to be true for jump. Unconditional jump, jump to foo, is just jump to foo if always. So the always value says it's the unconditional version of that instruction. And the other values represent less than equal, less than, greater than, and so on, according to this table, which you don't have to memorize. Look it up when you need it. Questions about our conditional instructions? Okay. We also have this line labeled opq. You might say, what's op? So op is a placeholder for all the arithmetic. So the arithmetic instructions are very similar. And rather than giving them separate lines in this table, our textbook author said, we'll just have them have the same basic instruction, but we'll just use these 4 bits to distinguish which of those arithmetic operations we're doing. So there's this table. We support add, subtract, and an XOR. We determine which one we're doing by looking at that least significant 4 bits of the first byte. And you'll notice that the instructions which don't have this, the textbook authors have just chosen to put a fixed value, in this case 0, in that least significant 4 bits, you know, because there's nothing interesting to put in that sort of part of the instruction, and they decided to put the same information in the same part of corresponding instructions. So next, we have some instructions which take register operands. And for consistently, we put the registers in the second byte of the machine code of the instruction. For instructions which only take one register, depending on which operand that is, we either put that in the first slot for push RA and RB, or the second slot. And we leave a placeholder value of 15, F and hexadecimal, in the other slot. And this is a table of our register numbers. Remember that we omitted R15, so the register, the bits 15 in there are not meaningful. They don't represent a real register. But otherwise, we convert from our assembly to machine code by saying, oh, if the assembly has RDX, we put a 2 in that slot when writing out the machine code. questions about our register numbers. Yes. The question is, where is the D go? We'll get to that in a bit. The D field of R move Q and M R move Q. Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. We haven't gotten there yet. And I guess one thing I should point out, which I didn't mention explicitly before, is that you may notice that the order of RA and RB for MR move Q is not what you expected. That is intentional. There's not a typo in this table. Okay, so that's our register numbers. So numbers to identify the register. So note these aren't register values there, because we're just saying what operation to do. And then we have some other fields. So one thing we need is mentioned for our memory move instructions, we have a displacement. And also for our immediate to register move, we have a constant. So we need to put that in the machine code somewhere. And we're going to have that be an 8-byte number we'll store in little endian in the next 8 bytes of the instruction. We also have an address constant, which I call dest in this diagram, and our conditional jumps and calls. We'll store that again as an 8-byte number that's an address in little endian order. Some questions about anything about this encoding here? Thing on the table. Yes. So these square blocks are half a byte. These green boxes are 8 bytes. Other questions? And I guess I should emphasize, because it might not be clear, that I'm writing this sort of in a way where we could naturally write sort of a sequence of hexadecimal bytes. So so we're writing the bytes in the order from lowest to highest address, but the parts of a byte, we're writing the most significant part on the left, the least significant part on the right. So this is the encoding, and our textbook authors supply a tool that you can get with HTLRS that you'll probably want to download for the lab. You construct the archive on make, and one of the things that we'll build is a tool called YAS, the Y86 assembler. So our textbook author's assembler, it's not an assembler that works the same kind of way you're used to for x86. So one big way it's different is that it assumes that you give it an assembly file, which is an entire executable, so there's no separate linking step. The assembler goes from assembly to basically an executable. So we can have something like this, and the assumption is that execution will start at the beginning and go to halt in this case, and that's our executable. And if you run our textbook author's tool, it will produce a .yo file, which, despite the name, I would think of as an executable file. Yes, they unfortunately chose the object file extension, but it's really more like an executable. There's no information to combine it with other .yo files. It's self-contained. In the lab, we'll have you build something more like object files, where you'll have to add that extra information we need to combine it with other object files. But these are basically executable files. And you'll notice, for example, we have this jump if greater than instruction for this loop, which has been converted into a conditional jump instruction. So 7 was the row of the table. If we go back to here, 7 was the row of the table for conditional jumps. And we have our destination field in little endian. And that destination field, these are the bytes. So 1e is the first byte, 00 is the second byte of it. So if we think of that as a number, that's 0x1e. That's referring to this address of this subtract instruction here. Another thing you'll notice is that I could point out where things on this were, because the executable format is not really designed like a real OS's executable format would be, like to be loaded. It's designed so you can actually read it for debugging. So that's handy for us. If we were cared about performance, wouldn't be handy. We'd like something that we just copy into memory directly. But that's what it looks like, so you can actually figure out what's going on, and you can see that they've listed out the bytes. You know, ideally there might be like a space between the bytes. They didn't do that. But we just have the hex values of each byte, one after another, from lowest to highest address. Yes? The question is, what's the 6 in the jump greater than instruction? So if we go back to our table of condition code, 6 is for greater. Your question? So this .yo, I would think of as executable. The extension is an unfortunate choice by our textbook authors. But it doesn't have the kind of information we'd need in an object file to combine it with other object files. So the question is that this is the result after we go from object file to executable. This is the result we get from an executable. The YAS tool doesn't actually have a way of producing something that looks like an object file, even though it's doing the same work that a linker would do internally. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so I'm guessing
YAS doesn't have a symbol table. So our textbook authors didn't define a format with a symbol table. I wouldn't say YAD6 does or doesn't have one, because usually we don't think of object file stuff as part of the instruction set, because you could imagine implementing two different ways of doing object files for the same instruction set. And the hardware, it wouldn't matter, right? It'd still work the same way. Yes? So the question, is this still little endian? Yes, yeah, so what this is specifying, I would say, is it's the byte values are listed from left to right, and each byte value is written in the way we would write it out, like in C or English, right? So for each byte value is written with the most significant part of the byte first, because that's how we write it. Like if I was writing in C, I would write this as like 0x30, comma 0xf0, comma 0x64, and so on. So this is just writing that out without the extra characters, basically. But it's still little endian, because when we convert those byte values for the line, for the jump greater than line, when we convert the 0x1e, comma 0x00, comma 0x00, so on, to an address, we're going to say the least significant part of that is the lowest address. The 0x1e is the least significant part. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do some exercises encoding YAD664. So let's start with an x86-64 program. Year, so I have, well, not program, function. This add one function. We add one to our argument. And I have my x86-64 code. That's not correct for YAD6. One way I can tell is there's no move queue in YAD6. It's something else. So what is a correct YAD664 version of this assembly? Give you a little time to look at this. So who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay, so we have a large majority on C and D, which I think are both reasonable translations. So in the case of C, we've decided to change what register we use for are temporary. Basically, we move one into REX, add that one into RDI. Get our results. So we've moved things around a bit from the original logic of the code, but it achieves the same result, and it's probably the most natural way of doing this in YAD664. D is a more direct translation of the original code, where we said, well, we still want to do a move from RDI to REX like we do at the beginning, but I need to put one somewhere, so I'm going to put it in RDI, because I can't do an add of the constant 1 into REX directly. That's not allowed in YAD6. Remember, we can only have one type of operands for each instruction. For adds, we can only have registers. So we have to have some sort of 1 moved into a register to do this. So questions? Yes. So question, I think I said that D was a direct translation. I think D is the most direct translation of the code in that it like tries to use the same registers as much as possible.
So to clarify, is both C and D correct?
Question, are both C and D correct? Yes, both C and D are functions that do the same thing. A doesn't work because that add instruction won't assemble in YAD664, and B is not correct because it puts the result in the wrong register. Yes? So the question, wouldn't C be more direct? So I'm saying more direct in the sense that D is closer to what I'd get if I went instruction by instruction in the original. In that, like, I tried to translate the move instruction to something from the original assembly. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we'll go with version C and work on assembly. And basically, my procedure for turning this into machine code is I'm going to look at my table, and I'm going to take the row of my table and fill in the blanks. So in my row of my table, I have the row for IR move Q first, which started with 3-0. So that means our first byte is going to be 3-0. And then we had F and RB, which was, in this case, is REX, followed by our constant. So right now, I'm going to just say REX. I'm going to have to look up what that is. But whatever that is represented by, whatever 4-bit number that's represented by, it's going to go in that box. And then I have to put 1 in this 8-byte box. And remember, it's in little endian, so I've written it out as bytes from lowest to highest address. So the lowest byte is 0-1, then 0-0, then 0-0, and so on. Remember, little endian puts the least significant byte first. And I'm just writing out the byte values the way I would in C, so like we're writing constants in C, the most significant part of M is at the beginning of each of the constants. I have a sequence of 8 constants for each of the 8 bytes. So questions on how I got this template here? Yes. Question is the entire instruction stored in the little endian. So we didn't specify the instruction as like a big number. So I wouldn't say we have an endianness to the instruction as a whole. We specified the instruction being explicit that, you know, that this is the first byte and this is the second byte. So we by first I mean lowest address byte, second lowest address byte plus 1. Address. So we know exactly where things are without like referring to how do we represent a number. That was on the table. So if you look at our table here, these numbers on the top tell us which index byte we're in. So we explicitly told you byte 1 is this stuff. Byte 0 is this stuff. We don't have to think about endianness to know where that is on the table. The only time we need to think about endianness with this. So when we have a box that spans multiple bytes, we need to figure out how does it map to those multiple bytes. So other questions? Okay, so I have this box for RIX, so I'm going to expand that using the table I showed you earlier, and we find out, oh, RIX has the number 0, so I'm going to put a 0 there. Then I go to my next row. I know it's the opq row, so I have a blank to fill in for whatever the number we assigned to add was of all the arithmetic operations, and the number we assigned to RDI and RAX. I look those up in the tables I showed you earlier, and I find out that add was 0, so the first byte of that instruction is hex 60, and I find out that RDI was 7, RAX is still 0, as far as how we encode them in machine code, so the second byte is 70. Then I look up return. Return doesn't have any operands, so I just look up in the table, find 90, I'm done. There's nothing to fill in. So as for how this is in memory, I can just write these out. And I've just written this out as a sequence of hexadecimal values of bytes from lowest to highest address. I've highlighted where the instructions start for readability, but in memory, that's not going to be there, right? You're just going to have to based on the numbers. Yeah. Question, I wouldn't have to include the full number of bytes each time. What do you mean by the full number of bytes?
And then like the number like when it has a destination attached to the end, like you wouldn't have the zeros there.
So the question is, I don't pad the shorter instructions when I'm doing this? Yes. So the shorter instructions actually take up less bytes. This is why we say it's not fixed length encoding, it's variable length. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how does this relate to the object file? So this would be how we construct what goes in the machine code part of the object file. And also would end up in the executable and in memory, because this is what the processor is going to read from memory to run a program. Yes? So the question is, why did I get 70 for the second line? So when I looked at my table here, I found out that opq, we had a 6, a number to represent what operation it was, and a number for register A and register B. And register A was RDI. In this table, that's a 7. And register B was RAX. In this table, that's a 0. So that gave me 70. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? So let's do a second example. So here I have a little snippet of assembly where I have an add and a jump to the add. So I'd encode the add like you've seen before. So I have 6, need the number for add and the number for the two arguments, which in this case are RAX. So I look those up, I'm going to get 6000. So that's our first instruction. And then I need to encode the jump greater than. And to do that, I need to know what the address is that it's going to jump to. So as we learned, In the full process, we'd have some sort of linking step in between here. But for this example, I'm just going to assume I know its address hex 123. And if I know that, or if maybe the linker knew that, we'd end up having our jump instruction encoded with a 75 at the beginning. Why 75? 5 was the number for greater than or equal in the table. 7 is the first part of conditional jump instructions. And then I have my address in little endian format. The least significant byte of this address is 23. So that's the thing at the lowest address, the first thing, the leftmost thing I read in my line. Then 01, the second least significant byte, 00, third least significant byte, and so on. And if we're thinking about how this would work with object files, well, that number there would be filled in because a relocation would point to it, and then it would be replaced with that as part of the linking step. Some questions about this example here? See any? So we've talked about going from assembly to this machine code. Let's talk about going the other direction. So here, I have some machine code. And I have the table for decoding it, because it'd be really annoying to do this from memory. So first part, what are the first three instructions? What are the types of the first three instructions? Like, which row of the table are they? So how can we figure that out? Could someone tell me how to figure out the type of the first instruction? So which row of the table is the first instruction from? So, yeah.
The two.
Two. So the two row, how do you figure that out? Starts with a two. So the first byte of the instruction is going to correspond to the first byte of the table. We have two and anything. So it's not necessarily, like, we have a zero here, but we don't need to look for that. We just look for two and anything. So it's some sort of register to register move, conditional or not. Okay, how about, what's the type of the second instruction? Or you have a question? Okay, so what's the type of this? How do I figure out the type of the second instruction? So, yeah. Okay, so you're saying the second one has these four boxes, which correspond to two bytes, so two of these numbers. So I can say, okay, you know, since I must have used two slots here, so this is where my second instruction starts, at that six. And that six is the op queue line. And I can repeat that process. So I can say, okay, the op queue, it takes up two bytes on our table. So I can look and say, oh, this instruction ends, you know, just before the byte with index 2, so it's 2 bytes, 0 and 1. Index 0 is index 1. So after the 6 instruction is another 6 instruction, so another op queue, and that's going to again be 2 bytes for the same reason. And after that, we have an instruction that's the 7. And our 7 instruction picks up 9 bytes. So I'm going to figure out where the next instruction after that is. I can say, okay, so this is the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth byte of the instruction. So our next instruction starts there. And is another of the R move Q family. And I just keep doing that until I go through all my instructions, and I can find out where all the instructions start, which is usually the first step I'd have for decoding something like this. So questions about how I found the starting point of all the instructions and which line they were corresponded to? Okay, so not seeing any. So once I've marked where the instructions start, so that I've just highlighted where I found all those instruction starting locations, I can go through them and figure out how they decode by looking at the subfield. So for example, for the first instruction, the 2010, I think, look at how that corresponds to my table. So the zero is the CC. I look up in my table, and that's the always. So that's conditional move of always, which is the normal RR move Q. And I look up RA. What does that correspond to? Oh, that's RCX, because 1 is RCX in the table, and 0 is RAX in the table. So I get RR move Q, RCX, RAX. So questions on how I did this translation of that first instruction? And I can repeat that for, say, our opq instructions. I have the extra wrinkle. I have this fn field. Again, I look up in my table. I find 0 is add, 1 is subtract. So I get those. I look up the register numbers the same way. Then I have a jump instruction. So it's on the conditional jump line. I look up the cc field. I find out it corresponds to less than. So it's a jl. But where does it go? Well, I have this little endian number. The lowest address part of that little endian number is 84. So it's 0x84 is the bottom part. And, well, the top part's all zeros, so it's a jump less than to 0x84. If I wanted to write this as more readable assembly, I'd, like, put a label somewhere, but we don't have that information here. And I can just keep going on like that. Some questions on how I did this decoding. Any part of doing this? Okay, so looks like we're hopefully set on that. Something we're going to need to have, we're going to write simulators to do that, so we better be somewhat comfortable with how it works manually. And since we're talking about building hardware, we're going to have a little digression into how we describe hardware. So one way we can describe hardware is kind of with pictures of what would be circuits. So here I have a picture of, like, we have an add circuit with an add one part that's connected to some storage. We'll learn that that's how we represent registers, called count in a circuit. And this is a common way we'll end up representing hardware. And also, it could be a way you, like, design hardware professionally. Like, there are even commercial tools called schematic capture tools for designing hardware by drawing pictures in a program and having that eventually be translated into, like, something you could, instructions for building hardware. These are not commonly used for processors. And basically, what happened is people wanted a more traditional programming language, so typically they use a more text-based programming language, and they want abstractions. So you can do abstractions in that drawing pictures, but it seems simpler to do that in a text-based representation. And we're going to abstract away a lot of details that we don't really want to care about in this course. Like, we're not going to talk about how we go from the gates we discuss when we discuss bitwise operators to things like addition or multiplication. We're just going to assume that that's done by someone who's in another class. We're not going to talk about how to build, like, registers from transistors. That's something that needs to happen. We're just going to say we basically have in our programming language for hardware, we have a library which has registers available to us and memories available to us. We don't have to figure out how they work from smaller components. And there's some other abstractions we'll use. One of the important ones is muxes. We're not going to really care about how you build those from the, like, hardware components. We're just going to say, you know, that's going to be provided to us as a library. And if you want to learn how to build those, that's a topic for, like, CS2330 or some ECE courses, or both. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the semester, we're going to use a tool called HTLRS that's built for this course, assumes you're making a processor, and is based on our textbook's HTL, but it has some differences. Because it has those differences, I'm going to try to go over it pretty clearly in lecture about how it works over the next couple days, as well at the same time as we're describing sort of high-level ideas about how hardware works. So our abstraction of hardware, we want to talk about, you know, how to build things, and I'm going to look at both drawing the picture version and also what our corresponding HTL code will look like. But one thing we need is we need to have sort of values that move around. And we're going to represent them with what we'll call wires. And in hardware, sort of our simple notion is that we have a wire that has a voltage. That voltage is either high or low, which represents 1 or 0. So a wire holds a binary value. But typically, we're not acting on a single bit. We want to act on more than a bit. So here I have a 5-bit value I want to act on. And how do I move that around? With 5 wires, a bundle of 5 wires. And the idea is we can put a value as a voltage on one end of the wire, and it will just electrically propagate with some small delay to the other end. And that's how we transmit numbers in our hardware. Now, since we're commonly going to be working with like 64-bit values, I don't want to draw 64 lines like this, and multiple sets of them. So we're going to like try to simplify things. So here I have the value 26 in decimal being sent across a wire. This is sent across a bunch of wires. And I can represent that more compactly, like so. So I'm just saying, rather than writing the value of each bit, I'm just saying this bundle of wires holds 26. But most commonly, I'm going to kind of represent a bundle of wires as sort of a single line. And I'll often, for shorthand, just call the whole thing a wire, even though it's really a wire bundle. And that might look something like this. So I just have a thick line that I've labeled 26. So that's, I'm saying that's a bundle of wires holding the value 26 spread across, you know, physically multiple wires. And sometimes I will be explicit about how wide that bundle is, and I'll do some notation like this, where I've drawn a little slash across it, and here I have a 5 underneath to indicate it's 5 bits wide, meaning that it has 5 wires building up that bundle. But commonly, I'll just use the shorthand of saying this is a 5-bit wire, even though really it's 5 wires put together. So questions about this sort of short visual shorthand for bundles of wires? Okay, so we're also, in addition to talking about moving values around on wires, we're going to have to talk about doing calculations. And we mentioned that we had this component that did calculation called gates. And gates do these simple calculations of like, you know, in this case, XOR. We have XOR and those simple calculations. We have like circuits where we take in some wire inputs, and with some delay, they will output some result. And we can put these gates together to do more general calculations. And we're going to just work with this sort of very generic version of a calculating circuit that would really be built from these gates, where we're going to say we have some circuit where we input on some wire bundle a value and get a function of that value with some delay. And I'll just draw that as a box labeling what the calculation is. So here I have a function which take a wire, so this logic circuit which takes in 12 and outputs a function of 12. You know, and presumably in the hardware that would work. I have the wires that go into that box, have a value, and with some delay later, the wires coming out will have the result of the calculation. And note that the size of the result might be different than the size of the input. So like I could input like a 64-bit value and like get 1 bit out, for example. That would be a possibility. Or I could input a 64-bit value and get another 64-bit value. All of those are possible. This is just a very generic shorthand for we're doing some calculation, and it's someone else's job to figure out how to make that work in hardware. We just want some box. We put in some values on wires and get some value out on wires. So questions? Abstraction. Okay. And I mentioned that we would be looking at having a text representation. So in HCLRS, we're going to have values moving around on wires. And we're going to write a wire bundle. We're just going to call it a wire. And this is how I would declare it and make it be assigned, meaning that it's connected. Think of like an electrical connection to 26. So I've supplied a name. And I have a colon and supplied a width in bits, so how many bits this wire bundle has. So how many wires are bundled together. And I've done this assignment, which is a connection. So this doesn't mean it has 26 now and can have a different value later. It's permanently connected to 26. It can't have any other value because that's what it's connected to. Like, you can't unconnect it. So if we wanted to have a variable value, we'd have to assign it to something that changes. We'll talk about how to do that as we talk about building a processor. So I think that's where I'll leave off today. So next time we'll talk about sort of extending this to representing calculations and maybe storing information.